this deep desire to live according to the teachings of awakening, to awaken myself, to support others to awaken, to bring peace and joy to myself and others, to learn how to really take care of suffering and share that with others. That's what I'm here to do and nothing else.
Hello, and welcome back to Religion to Reality, the podcast about living an integrated life. I'm your host, Dave Plisky, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Father John Gribowich. This season is all about listening. And to do that, we as Catholics are trying to listen from outside the church to a whole range of voices. We just finished up listening to a Hindu and a Catholic contextualizer about Hinduism in our last couple episodes. And this episode begins our Buddhism arc. And it's going to be a little bit longer of an arc. Not because Buddhism is more important or anything like that, but really because we just happen to know more Buddhists, especially Father John. He's got personal relationships with a number of really deep thinkers and feelers and really insightful Buddhists and Buddhism practitioners. So I think we just went for it. And so we're going to begin by listening to Kyra Jewel Lingo, who, as you're going to hear in a minute, spent serious time with Thich Nhat Hanh, living in Plum Village. So if you're familiar at all with Buddhism, I know many of us have become more familiar with Buddhism because of figures like Thich Nhat Hanh, who kind of really opened it up to the West, at least textually, and of course through his work, through his life. I hope you find this as rewarding as I did. Let's get into it. Kyra Jewel Lingo is a senior Dharma teacher in the Plum Village Zen lineage and a Vipassana teacher and a member of the Plum Village North American Dharma Teachers Council of Elders. Her work continues the engaged Buddhism developed by Thich Nhat Hanh, drawing inspiration from her parents' lives of service and her father's work with Martin Luther King Jr. After living as an ordained nun for 15 years in Thich Nhat Hanh's monastic community, Kyra Jewel now teaches internationally in the Zen and Vipassana traditions, as well as in secular mindfulness contexts. Her teaching focuses on the intersection of racial, climate, and social justice, with particular care for Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities, as well as activists, artists, educators, families, and youth. Based in New York, she offers spiritual mentoring and is faculty in a Buddhist eco-chaplaincy training and one of the guiding teachers of One Earth Sangha. She is the author of We Were Made for These Times, 10 Lessons in Moving Through Change, Loss, and Disruption, and co-author of Healing Our Way Home, Black Buddhist Teachings on Ancestors, Joy, and Liberation. Kyra, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you. You and John know each other a bit, is that right?
Yes.
Yes, primarily through Kyra's husband, Adam.
Right.
And I have to say, I was a very big fan of your book, We Were Made for These Times, and also Healing Our Way Home. And I've used a lot of the content from both of those books in different things I've done on my own. So thank you for letting me steal from you lots of different ways.
But, it's an honor.
But I've always really thought that it's so great to see a certain type of synergy that starts to emerge with various different traditions, and realizing that at the end of the day, the pursuit for spiritual development, formation, and what we even call religiosity, I think all just taps into what it means to be human. And I like to think of that when we look at the practices, especially within the Buddhist tradition, they're helping to make us human rather than maybe making us Buddhists, as we would maybe try to understand that from like some type of like doctrinal standpoint. So I've appreciated how what you've done is so accessible to so many. I guess that's what I'm trying to really get at. So,
thank you. That's really lovely to hear.
But I think a lot of that has to do with your own background and your own traditions. And I say that plural because of how many different types of things have influenced you.
Yeah.
And maybe we can just start with there. Can we just start to unpack, like, sure. How did you get to where you are today?
Sure.
And you can start however wherever you want to start.
Okay. Well, I would say both of my parents were real spiritual seekers. They were really committed. Like, my mom went to look for her own church at age 12 on the west side of Chicago. Like, she interviewed different churches. She went to different places on Sundays to figure out where she wanted to go to church. And so she was just a very kind of precocious, very independent-minded, just a really curious person who really wanted to understand. And she's been a devout Christian her whole life. And my dad, so my mom is Black from the west side of Chicago. My dad is a white Southerner who grew up really, I think, understanding the lies. I mean, early on in college was like really got that he'd been told a lot of lies about, white superiority and white supremacy. And so we really began to question that. And I think that was part of his faith journey that led him then to go to seminary and to become a minister. And then both of my parents met, as, my dad had come to the west side of Chicago because he was part of this order ecumenical, this community that had set out to renew the church, to make, the Protestant church really responsive to the needs of the time. You could call it engaged Christianity, looking, through the lens of engaged Buddhism that Thich Nhat Hanh brought about, a kind of brought attention to. And so my mom got interested in this community, and they were both just spiritual seekers that were part of this community that was quite visionary. I mean, all communities have a shadow, all communities have unexamined places. And so this community was not different. I mean, it had its shortcomings, but it was doing something pretty revolutionary at the time, which was really trying to say, it's possible for all of us to see ourselves as citizens of the earth and to work on behalf of everyone, including the poor, and to not use religion as a weapon, but to really go into places, villages, indigenous reservations, slums, rural areas, and to gather people in town meetings and say, what do you think your community needs? And then help that happen, driven by the people in that community. So they established, thousands of these human development projects all over. There was one in every time zone, at the height of this community. So my parents were part of this community that was kind of built, it was structured around a monastic model. It was lay people with, couples with children, but we all lived very simply. People didn't have personal income. If people worked outside the community, they pooled their money. And so everyone got a very basic kind of stipend each month. And we had hand-me-down clothes, and we had in-kind food that was, kind of the food bank kind of food. And so there was this real value of simplicity, and then living communally. So we woke up every morning at 5 in the morning. On Easter morning, the words really came to me this year. Every morning, someone would come around with a bell and ring it outside your door and say, "Praise the Lord, Christ is risen." And we had to respond, "He is risen indeed." So they would know we were awake, and then they would go on to the next door. So we were in this 8-story old insurance building on the north side of Chicago. By the time I came along, our community had moved from the west side to the north side. And so it was 300 people living in this building. We had a schedule. We had a morning daily office, is what we called it, in the tradition of the monastic, lineage. And then, we went to school. The adults did their work. Some worked outside. Some worked for the community. And one night a week, we had family night. All of our meals were otherwise with the kids. The adults were with the adults, and we were with the kids. So one night a week, we got to eat dinner with our parents. So it was really like you give your life to this community, and your family is part of that, you know. So that's how I grew up until I was 14. I was born into this community, and so I lived, you know, 4 years in Nairobi, Kenya, where there were 500 village development projects in Kenya. It was a very international organization, and had friends from all over the world. And we're still friends with a lot of these people. These are part of our extended family even today. And so I left, you know, that community. The community ended because of financial reasons. It still goes on as a nonprofit, but the residential part ended. And I remember leaving at age 14, 15, whenever, like my first years outside of this community in a high school, coming home from high school and just thinking, this can't be all there is to life, like a consumer society of, you know, everyone living in their own homes. And, you know, I think I really felt the longing for the meaning that I had touched in this community, where, you know, every week we would sit down and someone would choose a really good film. I remember we watched really good artistic films that had a message. And sometimes, a lot of times, they were foreign films, and we would watch, and then we would have an hour-long discussion about it, like a group of 20 or 30 people. This was every week, so I was being fed in so many ways, you know, as a curious, you know, teenager and preteen. Like, people, adults cared about what we thought as kids. They asked us. We were part of discussion. So, coming out of that to a single, you know, a single family home, going to high school and coming back, it didn't make sense for me, you know, and I think I just was longing for the community that had just inspired me and made sense in terms of, you know, living as a person who belonged to the whole world and that wasn't in a consumer, you know, mainstream, you know, make a lot of money, be successful. That just never was what appealed to me. So naturally, as I found myself going to college, I chose the most communal situations, like the house on campus where everyone cooked for ourselves. We didn't have cooks. We cleaned for ourselves. It was the cheapest place to stay because we did everything for ourselves, but we made our decisions by consensus. We grew food. We, you know, composted everything. We had a garden. Anyway, those were the places I was attracted to because they had more of those communal elements that I was used to growing up. And then, you know, there in that one house that I lived in my senior year, I was at Stanford. A friend told me about Plum Village, and was planning to go to the summer retreat. This was 1997, and so I knew as I was finishing college, I was like, I've learned a lot here, but I haven't learned how to be happy. I haven't learned a spiritual discipline, which I really knew I needed. So I just thought, after I finish college, I'll travel for a year and look for a teacher, a spiritual teacher, and a community. That's all I knew. I didn't have any particular religion in mind. I was just like, let me just find someone who can guide me in a community. That's what I knew. And so I went to India for 3 months. I, you know, visited different ashrams. And then in the summer, I came to the Plum Village summer retreat. And as soon as I saw Thich Nhat Hanh, I knew this is my teacher. And I was there for the whole month for the summer retreat. And I was very impressed by the community. They were practicing what he taught. And I thought, this is the real deal. So I canceled the rest of my trip around Europe. I was going to travel for 4 more months, and I just stayed in Plum Village. And at the end of that time, I thought, well, if I like this so much, why don't I do this all the time instead of working for a year just to come for a week-long retreat? So then I had the idea to become a nun. And two years later, I became a nun. So I lived in the community for a year. I went home and worked, and I came back. And then I lived in the community for a year. And then in 1999, I became a nun. And so I lived in that community for 15 years, and I learned a lot about how to be happy. I'm still learning, but I did learn what I, you know, the tools and the practices that completely shaped my life and just Having Thich Nhat Hanh as my kind of root teacher has just been the biggest gift of my life. And that's really like, I just think I will always be his student. Like for many lifetimes, I'll just be trying to follow his footsteps and live out what he was trying to transmit. And when I think about what is my purpose on this earth, I'm like, I just want to be a good continuation of Thay, we call Thich Nhat Hanh Thay or teacher in Vietnamese. And so I've had other wonderful teachers also that I deeply respect and admire. And I just feel like he opened the way for me of really helping me see like my bodhicitta, this deep desire to live according to the teachings of awakening, to awaken myself, to support others to awaken, to bring peace and joy to myself and others, to learn how to really take care of suffering and share that with others. That's really I'm really clear. That's what I'm here to do and nothing else. So yeah, that's I guess how I mean I left that monastic life over five years ago, 10 years ago now. Yes, 10 years ago. So I've been living as a lay teacher practitioner since then, and just still, trying to learn and grow and share what I've received. And now as a married person to married to an Episcopal priest, someone who shares the fervor that I have of spiritual practice, but it's just in this different form of a Christian. And I, having grown up Christian, there's so much that resonates, but I never studied and learned the way I learned so much from Adam. Oh, the Bible says that. Oh, that's why Jesus said that. It's like it's so wonderful to hear him as he prepares a sermon or as he tells me some background of, the deeper meaning of something that, you just learn on the surface in a basic kind of Christian education. So it's just so wonderful to be in an interfaith marriage and doing this work together of trying to create a center where people can come and practice together and with informed by these traditions. So all of that just feels very rich and Adam has shaped me as well, even though it's just been the last 6 years. He's really shaped who I am as well in this new form that I'm growing into.
I think it's just so beautiful to hear about how you both form each other through your different traditions, experiences. I mean, as someone who's worked with married couples, I mean, a great source of tension can often be different religious traditions, different ideas of spirituality. But to be able to see how they come together in a very beautiful way is just very hopeful for anyone to hear. Actually, let's just talk a little bit about Thich Nhat Hanh, just because you had so much time with him.
That's where I was going to go
Tell us a little bit, like, what you found compelling about him, like, personally. Like, I mean, I've read tons of his books. I've heard him talk in different ways, but, like, when you are there, what was it saying? Like, when you said he's the real deal, what made him the real deal in your mind? And did he also ever let you down too? Let's see if we go there too, you know?
I think he was the real deal for me because he really practiced what he preached. Like, I never saw him rush. I mean, he could walk fast. When we even had jogging meditation sometimes if we were out doing our slow walking meditation as a group, because every day we would have, a period of 1 hour of walking meditation outside. And when he would lead us, he would walk very slowly, very mindfully. It was just so beautiful to walk with him in the community and really like relax and really just feel you just didn't have to get anywhere. You could take in the beauty. We were in this beautiful, southwestern French countryside. And And if it rained, he would start jogging meditation. So he could move fast, but he didn't move unmindfully. Like he just, whether he was, on his own or with people, like he was really like fully there. And it was very powerful. Like I had several experiences where he was so present that he burned away something that was in me that was preventing me from, kind of being fully myself. Like that kind of level of presence that it just sort of like sparks something in someone else. But like, I remember I was just working on a book. I edited books that he was putting together, and sometimes he asked me, he was like, "Oh, we're having our 30-year anniversary. Would you put a book together?" So I put a book together and I was editing, and I just remember he came by the office and a bunch of us were in there on computers, and he just sort of, I don't know if he put his hand on my head or what, it was somewhere on my head or my shoulder, but it was just this transmission of like, all of the stress, all of the tension, just like he cared so much about us. And if he saw that we were, stressed or working too hard, he tried to really come and like relieve that sense of pressure. And he would always say, "It doesn't have to be perfect, like don't go overboard trying to make it perfect." But he was just someone who I just was never not inspired by. Like the way he would give teachings always made so much sense to me. And his just huge capacity, just intellectual, like he spoke all these languages, had studied all of these texts and was a translator of texts and could really make very deep ancient concepts completely relatable and concrete in a modern context. Like he tried to use our slang as young people, he tried to he'd said, you need to read these novels like to understand these cultural things. Like he would and he was an innovator. He was like, he wasn't afraid of new things or different things. He wanted us to be people who could understand the depth of the teaching that he had and was transmitting to us, but that we would always be open to learn and to be humble and to be skillful to see how can we apply the teachings, for this group of teens from France who, have smoke a pack a day. And like how do you teach meditation to kids who are addicted to phones? You have to teach it differently. So he was always doing that. He was, so his, I mean, for me, it just came down to his love and compassion for people was so vast that he would shapeshift to make it work for whoever he was in front of. So it was so not rigid, and he could sniff out rigidity in us so well, and he would really do a Zen master thing and be like, "You got to stop that," Like he would mess with things so that we couldn't get comfortable in our own rigidity and in our own comfort zones. He kept switching things up so that to teach us, stay awake, stay awake, stay awake, respond to what's in front of you, not, your ego or your, conditioning. Like these teachings are supposed to be alive and very direct and very, present moment. So he was always, messing with us to get us to not fall asleep. And he really valued relationships. That was something else. I think I, growing up in a community and just being maybe a outgoing kind of person, I'm very relational, and he was very, very, he really emphasized, I mean, you would often guess that in a monastic setting, a lot of people would be introverts because it's a lot, you spend a lot of time, meditating or, but in our community, there was so much emphasis on how we related. And sure, we had, the whole range, many extroverted people, many introverted people, but how do you really care for everyone and keep growing your heart to keep including more and more people? And I really felt that from him. Like I felt like he loved all of us, and there were some people that were very difficult to love, and he would still love them. And you could see that, and you could see how people who had a lot of suffering, who had a lot of difficulty, would transform in his presence, in the presence of the Sangha, that they would begin to understand themselves better, the community would understand themselves better. Like he just didn't take anything at face value, like he just wouldn't judge someone by something they were doing or something they said. He could always go deeper, like to look, for me, that's what it seemed like. He could just look into the heart of someone and see their goodness and also see their struggles and know how to help them, guide them so that they could go forward on the path and be less caught and be more free. And so, I mean, as far as did he ever let me down? I know there was one time where I wrote him a letter about something that I thought was not right that had happened in the community, where I felt like there might have been some way of listening to some people more than others that seemed not fair. So I said that to him in a letter, and he came back. I mean, I think a number of people might have written different things about different situations. And it was the beginning of the winter retreat. We were all gathered in one place for this retreat, which was rare. Usually we're all in separate monasteries. So he was with all of his students, all the monastic students, hundreds of us, probably 400 of us. And at the beginning of this monastic retreat, he did something different in the opening ceremony. Usually we bow to him as his disciples and we ask for his guidance for the 3-month retreat. Well, he got up and bowed to us and said, "I am sorry for this, 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 and this." And he included one of the things I wrote in my letter, and other people must have written to him too. And he said, "I'm sorry, I have made mistakes, or, and I ask for your guidance, and please help me in this 3-month retreat also." And that just blew me away. I was just like, oh my gosh. So he took that in, he listened, he saw maybe there was some little bit of something that I saw clearly, and he was very, very humble. And so that's pretty much the only thing that I can think of that I ever brought to his attention. And he very much responded without any pride, without any, I mean, I'm so far behind him on the path, but he, and not just to me, but to so many other people, he said, "I have made mistakes. I'm very sorry. I want to grow, and I please help me to grow."
Beautiful.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful story.
Thank you for sharing so much about him. He's true. I mean, I'm in John's boat. I've watched him, I've read him, and he's so inspiring. And like everything you're saying is just a kind of a model human type of thing to be, right?
Yeah.
Nothing to do with his persuasion or something.
Yeah.
But I did want to talk about that a little bit. So he comes from the Zen tradition, which is in the Mahayana Buddhist branch. And you teach Zen, but you also teach Vipassana, which is coming from the
Vipassana.
Vipassana. Thank you, coming from the Theravada branch. I wondered, how are those different, and how do you hold those differences? Is it obviously you might be teaching them in different way. I don't know. I'm just curious how you approach, kind of
Sure.
those things.
Yeah. Well, I think the main difference is that in the Vipassana tradition, it's silent retreats. So most of the form of sharing the practice is people come for a week or whatever length of time, and They might meet in groups with a teacher, but the rest of the time is silent. So sitting and walking, meals in silence. So you can, you know, you have a very, there's a lot more instruction on meditation because you're meditating more hours of the day. And it's a very deep dive into your own inner content, you know, really learning, why do I react this way? And why does my mind go here? Where am I shutting down when something painful comes up? You really start to see that over a week, you know, of like hour after hour on the cushion or walking where you're not interacting with someone. And in the Plum Village tradition, it's very interactive. So it's not in silence, although there is plenty of silent time during the day. There's a meditation every morning, every evening, and a walking meditation for an hour every day. And meals are partly in silence. But there's a lot more emphasis on being together as a community. So there's a lot more teachings on loving speech and deep listening and beginning anew in times of conflict. And how do you water the wholesome seeds in someone by noticing what they're doing well and really affirming that, and, you know, apologizing when you make mistakes, like just so many more, like, you know, and then working together, and how do you work, and then meeting and having, you know, how do you come to decisions in a way that includes everyone's insight? And, you know, so it's a different cultural stream. So Thich Nhat Hanh comes from Vietnam, and it's a more of a village culture. So, and it's Plum Village is the kind of heart of the community. And so, you know, this communal, you know, lots of festivals where we were encouraged to make dances and create songs and write poetry. So it's a very, that's also very Vietnamese, this very beautiful emphasis on the natural world and this beautiful long tradition of poetry and singing and dance and making music. And of course, it was a very international community. So then all of that got mixed in where we did, you know, a lot of different kinds of art was encouraged, and Thay was a calligrapher. So anyway, so there was a lot more what we call sangha building in the Plum Village tradition. And so plenty of instruction on meditation and walking meditation, but a lot more emphasis on like how you practice in your everyday life. And that's very much part of Vipassana as well. But that retreat, you know, the retreat experience is quite rarefied and sort of very different from daily life. And I think Plum Village was, you know, the Plum Village tradition, it's also the monastery is very different from daily life, but there's many more practices that are trying to help you bridge how to bring the practice into your daily life. So in a Plum Village center, you'll see gathas up, little poems up everywhere, like four-line poems with how to bring mindfulness to a certain activity. So when you're brushing your teeth, there's a four-line poem for how to brush your teeth in an awakened way. Going to the bathroom, there's a four-line poem about, you know, going to the bathroom. There's a four-line poem for taking a shower, for taking out the trash, for getting dressed, for drinking tea, for going into the meditation hall. So all of these things support you then when you go back to your daily life, that you've done these tiny little details with a lot more attentiveness. So actually, I think, you know, both Vipassana and Plum Village, the Zen practice, they take you to the same place, just it's a different route. Because if you're doing Vipassana and you're paying attention to every little detail because it's so silent, and you're asked, you know, you're invited to slow things down and to notice even your intention before you do something. Like you notice your intention before you turn the doorknob, that you have the intention to do that. That's a feature of our mind. We have a little moment of intention before we do such a simple act. You can slow things down to notice. So if you're learning that on a retreat, when you come home, some of that's going to shift how you do things because you've paid so much attention. You're going to notice a little more in all the aspects of your daily life. So it's just, for me, they're very complementary. They sit side by side very, very well. I didn't find any conflict in the two ways of practice. Like, I think it can be very beneficial to be completely in silence, to really have that deepening experience of yourself. And then it can be very powerful to be in a retreat where you're mindful but talking, you know, and where you have to practice mindfulness of speech and mindful listening and, you know, mindful, you know, it's like a lot of group process learning. How do you work with someone who's really suffering a lot? Maybe that person's you. How does the group hold that? How does the group, you know, support someone and you know, stay grounded and not get depleted? All these things, those are real skills, right? So I think, you know, they complement each other very well, and they kind of speak to various parts of our spiritual experience from different angles.
You know, so much of our emphasis this season of Religion to Reality is focusing on how can, say, Catholics be more receptive, better listeners, more attentive to ways that the Spirit is working outside of, say, the defined parameters of institutional Catholicism. And so that's why we like hearing from so many different perspectives. And you've given us so much to already just to meditate upon. On how that really reflects to anyone's disposition on how to show up to life, and also to recognize, I would say, an incarnational spirituality that every situation has something more than what we can see, that there's something that is showing us a vast interconnectivity, especially with people that we meet that maybe sometimes we don't automatically connect with for whatever reason. But there's something more there that needs to be explored. So maybe like in your experience, being so deeply rooted now in the different practices that you have kind of really have embodied, what would Christianity learn, or what how could Christianity benefit from what you have been able to experience? In the context of how you understood Christianity from your experience of that as well. Like, how did they feed each other? Like, was there a point where it's like, okay, my Christian upbringing and that sense of Christian community, that's done now. I'm onto something else. Or like, does it feed it? Is there
Totally.
an interplay? Because how
Yeah.
does that relate for like the Catholic or the Christian today to realize there's something of tremendous benefit that, say, the Buddhist tradition offers in order to become a better Christian, a better Catholic, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, Thay really encouraged us to go back to our spiritual roots, and he would often say, like, we don't need more Buddhists. The world doesn't need more Buddhists. He would say, you know, learn mindfulness if you like it, but let it help you be a better Christian, a better Jew, a better Hindu, a better Muslim, you know, a better atheist. You know, mindfulness can help anybody live more deeply. And so I definitely felt like I never experienced that I stopped being Christian just because I became a Buddhist. Like, and Thay had on his altar a picture of Jesus and Buddha arm in arm, hugging each other. And he bowed to that image every day. Like, he loved Jesus Christ. Thay was deeply, deeply inspired by the teachings of Jesus and had a lot of respect. I mean, he wrote two books on Buddhism and Christianity, and every Christmas, every Easter, he would do some kind of talk that you know, really honored that moment in the Christian year. I remember people coming to spend Christmas with us and saying, "This is the best Christmas I've ever had." And we really did Christmas like we did a special procession with candelaria, you know, lights in the paper bags, and we had you know, a play, a Christmas play every year. We had gifts, we had Christmas trees, we sang Christmas carols, we would go caroling to our neighbors. They would burst into tears because we had this four-part harmony of Christmas carols. So I mean, we really, so many of us monastics were from the West, and so this was our tradition, and so it was a way to stay connected to our own ancestral traditions, and we would sing gospel songs, and there was just a lot of Christianity that was very beloved in our Buddhist world. And so you know, I, you know, and Thay would often talk about the dual belonging, right? And one of our senior nuns, Sister Annabel Leyti, Sister Chanduk, wrote a book on mindfulness for Christians, because she also grew up Christian and was trying to just keep being a bridge, like Thay had been a bridge. And so Thay would say, you know, you can have dual belonging. And if you were raised Christian, he never wanted you to, you know, be separated from that, because he talked about how a tree without roots can't survive. So we need to stay connected to our roots, even if we are in a new, you know, in this current time, we're in a Buddhist, you know, what we're drawn to is Buddhist practice. We still want to stay connected to our Christian roots. And so one 3-month Rains retreat, he spent the whole, you know, he would give teachings twice a week. He spent the whole 3 months teaching on the rule of Saint Benedict, you know, and reading each passage and giving an interpretation from his perspective. So he really did a lot to encourage us to stay connected to our Christian roots. And so I think for, you know, Catholics and anyone of any tradition, what I loved about Thay's teaching was he said, whatever tradition you're coming from, go back and find the gems in your tradition and really keep them strong. And whatever, and you know, every tradition has its shadow, has ways in which the teachings have been distorted or not transmitted well. And he would say, find those things out too and transform them. So that it was this double responsibility to both lift up the really wonderful things, because those are there in every single tradition and they need to be kept alive. They need to be, you know, there's so many, it's like, I feel like traditions have left time capsules where the fullness of that wisdom will only be discovered by people later on. So there's still things that, you know, Catholicism is, you know, blossoming, that might not have been, like a seed was planted, but it might not have sprouted until, you know, many centuries later. So there's still things that need to be discovered and brought up, you know, like Father Thomas Keating and the monks in his monastery, going back to the cloud of unknowing, and, you know, these ancient texts where, you know, people hadn't been practicing that for some time. So there's always things like that that need to be kept alive and go back and, you know, find those things that have been lost or that have, you know, not gotten translated, bring them out. And then also, you know, the things that have gotten, you know, soured or twisted, or, you know, then we need to heal, bring healing to those too. So that was his sort of teaching to everyone, whatever tradition we're part of. You know, that's the work of every current generation.
You mentioned all of the things that you're learning from Adam, and I wondered if we could flip that. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know, what are all the things he's learning from you?
Well, I really am learning so much from him, and I'm so grateful. But I think, you know, one of the things he's appreciated learning from me is walking meditation. He started to practice when we, in the mornings, we would do a sit and then we would do a walk just through the house, just slow walk and being aware of our breath. And then he started to combine it with the Jesus prayer. So taking one step, Jesus, the next step, I trust you. Breathing in, Jesus, breathing out, I trust you. So he brought in his Christian, but the really taking time with each step, that was something that he got from me. And then I also shared with him the practice of beginning anew, which is this practice where anyone who lives together, works together, a couple, a parent, child, siblings, you take time at the end of the week to look back and just, or every 2 weeks or however often, to look back and appreciate what the other person has done that really was wonderful. You affirm the good things. We call it watering the flowers. So we say, you know, I really appreciate that you made dinner that night and, you know, or helped clean up when I was tired, or, you know, thank you for taking care of our dog. And, you know, this day I couldn't do this and you took care, or, you know, just thank you for listening to me when I was down. And so you go back and you don't take it for granted. Right. So that's one step. And then you also express regret if there's anything you've done that you wish you hadn't done or that you see caused suffering. And then you have a chance to just, you know, sometimes in the rush of daily life, we do things and we don't really have a moment to really take responsibility for it or be accountable for it. And so in the beginning anew, we can say, you know, I'm sorry, I was, you know, spoke harshly that time, I, you know, was stressed, or sorry, I didn't, you know, see that you needed more support in this moment, and I want to be there for you more in the future. So we take a time to really clear out any pebbles that are getting stuck in our relationship. And then if there's any hurt, we can also say, you know, this thing hurt and I just want to share with you so we can work it out, you know. So that's something we've really done on a regular basis since I shared that practice with Adam, is, and it, we really notice how much of a difference it makes, you know. Like, if we start to argue and we've spent, you know, each of us, because each of us talks for about 15 minutes and then the other person shares, if we've spent that much time sharing our appreciation for each other, an argument is much easier to resolve in the wake of that than if we've been sort of, you know, not nourishing each other in that way.
Kyra, you know, I love the title of your book, We Were Made for These Times. We know that these are very difficult times on so many different levels. So give us the word of hope. What makes you confident that we are made for these times? What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, this is the only time we have. So we can't be made for any other time because we're not in any other time. And so I think, you know, it's also this sense of, you know, leaning into the moment rather than away from it, to say, you know, if we're here, we do have what it takes to meet this moment and to respond in a way that's really going to be life-giving and supportive and transformative. And of course, we need each other for that. You know, we're not doing this alone. We're not made for this time alone, right? We're doing this together. Yeah, it's just this kind of, you know, one of Thay's calligraphies was, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
No, this is it. This is all. This is the only moment we have. And if we can take good care of the present moment, we will be okay in the future, because the future is made of the present moment. So all we have to do is take good care of this moment. We just take good care of our mind, our body, our breath, our relationships, the more than human beings in our world. You know, if we can just be present and attentive and learning and open and, you know, increasing our love right in this moment, that's what the future will be.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, Kyra.
What a joy to be with both of you. Thank you so much.
My, what a beautiful soul. We are so blessed to have been able to speak with Kyra Jewel-Lingo. And I just feel like we got this amazing insight. I just feel like we got to have this window into not only what her life might, a little bit was like during that formative time at Plum Village for her, but also even now, very practical and applicable, even though we're talking about such, deep contemplative ideas. So really, really wonderful. Get ready for a whole lot more of this in our, like I said, more exhaustive arc of Buddhists. Next up, we have Amy Kisei, next episode, who is also a Zen Buddhist and teacher, who has just another just gentle soul that I can't wait to share with you. So be sure to tune in next time for that. Religion to Reality is not just a podcast. It's also an interfaith monthly gathering. It's free for you to join online. We'd love to have you join us. We meet on the first Wednesday of every month. And you can find out more about that at our Substack, which is the religiontoreality.substack.com. And on the Substack, you can find where you can register for the monthly gathering. Religion to Reality was created and is executive produced by me, Dave Plisky. The show is produced and edited by Nick Stropoli and Connor Donnelly. You can find show notes and other resources at religiontoreality.org. And if you haven't, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.